So it's interesting to follow David Gross's talk with this much more prosaic sort of presentation, but I wanted to add one more question to his. And I'll add it up here. So the question is, how do we understand transport and recuperate? Well, I thought maybe it should be about 150th. So that's what I'll be talking about. I'll describe to you some experiments that we've been doing in infrared Hall effect in cuprates. And so I'll give you an outline. I'll remind you, I'm going to make a sort of tutorial because I think some of you at least haven't heard this, heard me talk on this before. And so what I plan to do is talk a little bit about, remind you of the experimental situation with transport and the models that have been used to discuss those experiments. I also remind you of the ARPAS results that are recently come out, which are very exciting, and how they, and also other high-frequency experiments that relate to transport and recuperates. Then I'll talk about the infrared Hall effect, a technique that we have developed for studying transport as a function of frequency, first in conventional metals to convince you that the technique works, and then high-temperature superconductors, in particular the YBCO cuprates. And we have recently obtained some data on underdoped YBCO. And then I'll discuss how these relate to the various models that have been put forth to describe transport and recuperates. And in particular, I want to discuss the comparison between ARPAS and transport transport and recuperates. So first, a very simple introduction about DC Hall effect, just to remind you of terms and so forth. DC Hall effect, we measure the transverse voltage induced in the presence of a magnetic field in the presence of a current. And the off-diagonal resistivity is the Hall coefficient times the magnetic field. And then the simplest picture of this, which is a grid of metal, in the weak field limit, which is what we're always dealing with here, sigma xx is just proportional to a scattering rate, and sigma xy is proportional to sigma xx times omega c tau, which is to say that the ratio of the two, sigma xy to sigma xx, the Hall angle, is a simple quantity, omega c tau. It relates to a relaxation rate. And in Drude model, of course, it's the same one. This Hall angle is essentially how far the electron goes around the Fermi surface before it scatters, and we're assuming weak field limit, so it goes a very small distance. And, well, I think that's all I need to say about that. And, of course, the history of the cuprates is that you have this linear resistivity with temperature, so that the implying a scattering rate that goes like temperature to very high temperatures, temperatures that are well above room temperature and high enough that one worries about the fact that mean free path actually becomes less than the Fermi wave vector. In the case of the Hall coefficient, the early results showed a very strange Hall effect. It's falling off with temperature. This is data from Ong's group. falling off with temperature, so it wasn't constant in temperature, as you might expect. Therefore, although the number density implied was roughly right and increased as you doped, as you made carriers, fewer carriers, it had a strange temperature dependence, was very hard to understand. And Ong and Anderson put forth the idea that if you look instead at the the tangent of the hall angle, or the cotangent of the hall angle in particular, you get a very simple behavior that describes the way that the hall effect works. That the tangent or the cotangent to the hall effect had a simple t squared behavior, and this implied within that simple Drude picture a scattering rate that was going like t squared rather than linear t, and put forth the notion that there may be two different kinds of scattering rates going on in the transport and the cuprates, one associated with ordinary conduction longitudinal conductivity, and another one associated with the Hall currents. Anderson put forth a picture of that, which was very appealing, that in terms of his charge spin separation picture, in which he proposed different scattering rates for hole on and spin on, and moreover proposed that the sigma xy ended up being essentially a combination of these two scattering rates in a way which is not completely clear to at least me. And because of this particular form of sigma xy, then the Hall angle ends up involving only the hole on scattering rate, whereas sigma xx involves only the spin on, sorry, I got it backwards. This is only the spin on relaxation, right, and this is only the the hole on scattering rate. And so then by the outcome of the, well, by he argued that these were the forms he should take, and experimentally these forms are observed in the sense that for the transport scattering rate, it appears that the scattering is maximum of omega and temperature, whereas the hole on scattering rate is essentially t squared, that is, as observed in resistivity DC measurements. Now, there were, of course, many.
Has anything measured higher, the hole angle or the hole relaxation rate at higher temperatures?
Yes. Yes, and I think it's fair to say that this perfect t squared behavior is probably not universally observed. There's a tendency for, when you plot a t squared, for it to roll over a little bit, indicating a slightly less than t squared type of behavior. But it has been observed to very high temperatures. There's a paper, I know data that it's measured up to about 800 Kelvin, and it still shows this general t squared behavior.
Is that optimal?
That was on.
Oh, okay.
This is optimally doped.
This is optimally doped, that's correct.
You could correct the Lenz expansion and things like that.
You mean, I don't think they correct their data for that, no.
Because if you don't do that, even the resistivity is not linear, right? The story is if you correct it, somehow it becomes linear again.
Okay. Well,
that you mean in the raw data, it's not linear?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I mean, I can't relate to that, but I must say that looking at the various data in the literature, I would say that neither the t squared nor the t seem to be universally observed. They're close to, but not universally observed. Perhaps the simplest, I mean, the most careful analysis makes it solid. I don't know the answer to that. Well, this very simple, appealing phenomenology led to a lot of different ideas about how you might explain this other than the charge spin separation proposed by Anderson. And I just listed here a number of these theories. Pierce Coleman and Schofield and Savelic introduced a theory which involved a charge conjugation excitations. So there were two taus associated with even and odd excitations of the system proposed. And Patrick Lee introduced a notion from spin charge separation that essentially the system is responding to magnetic field only when it's actually a hole. When it's a hole on, it doesn't effectively see magnetic field, only when it's actually a real hole. And so it leads to a temperature dependence of the essentially the Hall angle, coming from a temperature dependence of the relative amount of time that a hole is a hole rather than a hole on. The other models, there's Fermi liquid models. Ioffe and Mellis have a model in which they are proposing a cold spot along the nodal points where the scattering is minimum, and do an expansion around that to write a form for transport theory, which seems to have a lot of nice features, although it also seems to have some problems. Victor Yakovenko did a similar type of cold spot model in which he essentially just said, well, different regions of the Fermi surface have different scattering rates, and just calculated consequences with assumed scattering rates for different regions of the Fermi surface. Stokovich and Pines, with their nearly anti-ferromagnetic Fermi liquid models, they do detailed calculations of scattering rates around the Fermi surface based on their nearly anti-ferromagnetic excitations, and they get some degree of success with comparison of the transport properties. And finally, I'll mention one by Cotlier and Varma, in which they proposed that skew scattering occurs. The holes scatter with a skew scattering mechanism. If they consume a particular temperature dependence for the skew scattering rate, they can get the T-squared behavior of the Hall angle. I'll say a little bit more about some of these later. There's too many of these to go over in detail. I'd be happy to discuss them with anybody who's interested in them. I want to mention two others that are just purely phenomenological. This one was pointed out by Abraham, that if you propose that there's anisotropic scattering so that the currents perpendicular to the electric field and those parallel to the electric field scatter with different scattering rates, then the phenomenology that is observed falls out very naturally, and the Hall angle involves the perpendicular scattering rate. Although transport theory doesn't predict this type of behavior, of course.
I realize that this is not your problem, but how does an electron which is about to be scattered know?
That's exactly the problem, I think, from the point of view of transport theory. I mean, this is just an observation of a very simple picture which will give this behavior in a very natural way, except that it's not anything that you can get from theory.
I think if I recall rightly, there was actually a Boltzmann transport theory written down a fair time ago with this type of explanation.
Aren't you abandoning linear response theory altogether when we do this?
Yeah. Okay. You're saying that the electrons are scattering from a point on the Fermi surface, knowing whether or not there's an electric field or a magnetic field present there, rather than just scattering from that point. And that's what doesn't work in transport theory. So
the assumption is that the transport is fundamentally nonlinear to start with.
Correct. Yeah. Correct. So this is not a theory based on Boltzmann equation. This one is one that is simply this, that if you assume sort of pseudo one-dimensional conduction that would take place in the stripe phase situation, you can get something that looks rather like the experimental data, in which the Hall angle is governed primarily by the scattering rate perpendicular to the stripes, whereas the sigma xx is controlled primarily by the scattering parallel to the stripes.
This is independent of the direction of the field?
Yes, that's right. There is an assumption that the stripes are wandering, so that you have to average over different directions, but there's no other assumption.
Now, Dennis, the measurements I've seen of Hidetogakis go all the way up to 800 Kelvin with the T-squared Hall angle of doping. So if that were the case, you'd want to have a stripe phase or this anisotropic scattering extending all the way up
That's correct. Yeah. These two are more in the form of just, well, what sort of phenomenological models will give the kind of behavior that's observed? And, you know, these are just two examples, further examples of those.
And experimentally, you're always in a linear response regime, right?
Sorry?
You can check experimentally whether you're in the linear
response. Yes, absolutely, right. And we are. I mean, unfortunately, we are, because we have very low intensity of our sources. So, other experiments that, besides the transport, that relate to this, one of them being infrared conductivity, that has been measured back from the very beginning of ITC. Early measurements by Schlesinger back in the 90s showed sigma 1 as a function of frequency, and it is found to be, first, not in a traditional Drude 1 over omega squared kind of form, but rather some much more slow fall off of conductivity, more like a 1 over square root of omega. And in addition, it's found that at high frequencies, and I'm putting an arrow here at 1,000 because that's some frequency that we're going to be concentrating on, it is essentially temperature independent. Sigma 1 doesn't depend on temperature at all. And this type of data was what led to this phenomenological marginal Fermi liquid picture in which the scattering rate was taken to have the form of maximum of temperature or frequency. And by analyzing this frequency dependence of the conductivity in terms of inelastic scattering and by what is described as an extended Drude model, one can derive frequency-dependent scattering rates and frequency-dependent masses. This has been done by a number of authors. I'm still reporting Schlesinger's results here. And the scattering rate is seen to be essentially linear in frequency, and the frequency dependence of the mass is pretty slow. But this is this maximum T omega form for the scattering rate.
Of course, within marginal Fermi liquid theory, the tau star defined in that way should have logarithms floating around, correct there?
Yes, I think that's correct. I think that it wouldn't quite fit this data very well. Then there's the ARPA data, which is, we have seen coming out over the past couple of years, in which some very nice results, in which the widths of quasi-particle features are mapped. First along the pi-pi direction, and this is the data showing the imaginary part of the self-energy as a function of the excitation energy. And what is observed is that, well, at very low temperatures, the samples at 50 Kelvin, essentially the scattering rate is a linear function of energy, important energy, just like found in the infrared experiments. However, as the temperature is raised, what is found is that the, say at 300 Kelvin, the scattering rate is essentially independent of frequency until the frequency gets larger than the temperature, and then it goes up. So this is essentially the sort of marginal Fermi, well, I shouldn't call it marginal Fermi liquid, but the maximum temperature omega behavior that was observed in infrared. As they went away from the pi-pi direction, off in this way, they found that essentially it no longer went to very small scattering rates, but rather lifted off, and there was some angular dependent scattering. So the scattering rate has an angular dependence. And the temperature dependence as you go further away from pi-pi is very hard to measure very accurately because the quasi-particles get hard to define. But it is consistent with a picture that looks something like this, where there's an angular dependence plus this temperature and frequency dependence. So that sort of introduction to the phenomenology of transport in the cuprates. And I'm going to talk now about our technique of infrared Hall effect. And the first view graph just on the AC Hall effect itself, which in transport theory, linear response theory, we would just replace the taus that were obtained in the Drude model with their appropriate frequency-dependent parts, as you might get from a Boltzmann equation. And therefore, you end up with the frequency-dependent conductivity and sigma xy, and a frequency-dependent Hall angle. So the Hall angle now becomes a frequency-dependent quantity, and it looks sort of like a Drude thing. And in fact, it does have the properties of a response function in general, so that you can use the sort of spectroscopic techniques of Kramer-Kronig relation and dispersion relations to learn more about your experiment than you get from just the raw data. And so there are some rules associated with the Hall angle. And the Hall angle also has an invariant quantity, omega h, which is the integral of the Hall angle over all frequencies. And it's also important to point out at this point a difference between AC and DC, which I should have pointed out earlier, which is that in DC measurement, you're only looking at properties, you're not looking at dynamical properties, you're just looking at the mean free path. Appropriate average is the mean free path over the Fermi surface. If I can find this. So I'll put that back on this DC. So in a DC Hall effect, the sigma xy and sigma xx that we measure are in fact related to appropriate average of the mean free path over the Fermi surface. And sigma xy is another average of that. It's actually turned out to be an area type of average, an average of the area of a mean free path curve. And in AC measurements, though, we get information which is having to do with the energy scales of the system. So this, we instead get information about the scattering rate as an energy scale compared with the measurement frequency. And the use of the sum rules both for sigma xy and sigma xx allow us some extra flexibility in trying to understand the behavior of the transport. So we set out to do measurements of AC Hall effect on these kinds of systems. And the way the measurements are done, very briefly, is to send polarized radiation through a sample to have an analyzer that analyzes the resulting polarization of light coming through the sample, a detector, from which we're really measuring, these are films, the transmission parallel to the incident polarization and perpendicular to the incident polarization, from which we can convert into sigma xx and sigma xy if we also independently know sigma xx from an infrared measurement of the reflectance or transmittance of the film. We use this to measure first some properties of gold and copper, noble metals, to test the technique, and then we study high-temperature superconductors. So in the case of gold, which has a Fermi surface like this, if remind you, where there is some anisotropy, there are neck and belly type orbits. One knows the Fermi surface of gold very, very well, so one can compare the results with band structure calculations. The measured quantity is actually not the Hall angle, but the Faraday angle. We're actually measuring Faraday rotation, which we convert into Hall angle using the Fresnel equations and using the known sigma xx. These are the measured quantities for the imaginary and real part of the Faraday angle. It's a function of field. This field is swept up to 8 Tesla. This temperature is close to room temperature, and the frequency of the light is about 1,000 wave numbers or 100 millivolts. So these results in measurements, and I've plotted here the inverse Hall angle, which turns out to be the nice thing to plot because the Hall angle itself in simple models has this Drude form. And in these materials, where the scattering is much smaller than the frequency, you can show that this simple form it should be an accurate representation of the data because you're in a limit where the frequency is very high compared with the scattering rate. You can do an expansion of the transport and obtain the Drude-like form. The denominator, omega h, is something like the cyclotron frequency. It's really an average over the Fermi surface of the cyclotron frequency. And that is calculated from band theory, very well known. And so the imaginary part of the Hall angle, which should be this omega over omega h quantity, then should be proportional to omega. And its slope should be given by something calculated from band theory. And this is the predicted slope, predicted form of the imaginary part of the Hall angle. Whereas the real part should be something proportional to the scattering and should be independent of frequency if the scattering is independent of frequency. Since we're above the bifrequencies, we expect that we should be seeing scattering that's independent of frequency. And so this gives very good agreement. And then we look at the temperature dependence of these two parameters. And so this is the Hall frequency, temperature dependence. It's essentially temperature independent. This solid line is the theoretical result from a paper by Schultz and Allen in 1992. And the scattering rate, gamma, obtained from this same procedure, which is seen to be weakly temperature dependent, which may surprise you at first, and so you realize that these are very thin films. These films are about 100 angstroms thick, and so they're totally dominated by boundary scattering. So you have this huge offset boundary scattering, and then there's a weak temperature dependence on top of that. But the temperature dependence measured in the Hall angle is different than the temperature dependence measured in sigma XX, which are these solid lines, solid squares, which unfortunately have a little bit of noise in them, but it's clear that there is an offset. And that is understood. We can understand that in terms of the anisotropy of the Fermi surface. And so everything we feel is very nicely understood in the case of gold. And so then we turn our attention to high-temperature superconductors. And so I'm going to show two kinds of data. One is optimally doped samples, and the other one's underdoped down here at about 50 degrees Kelvin for YBCO. So first, to remind you of what the kind of frequency ranges we're looking at, we'll go back to the ARPIS data and show you our range consists of two ranges. There's a long wavelength range, a far infrared, where we have a continuous spectrum of photon energies to work with, up to about 200 wave numbers. And then in a near-infrared, using a CO2 laser, a small range of frequencies of around 20%, which is around 1,000 wave numbers. So first, I'll show you the far-infrared results. And these are results that were obtained in the first experiments on this, on YBCO at 95 Kelvin, in which first one sees is that the Hall coefficient obtained at these frequencies of 0 to 200 wave numbers is frequency dependent, which is not what Grutter model predicts. Grutter model would predict the Hall coefficient that would be purely real and independent of frequency. So there is a frequency dependence. The frequency dependence has a characteristic energy associated with it of about somewhere in the vicinity of 50 inverse centimeters. And if one converts the conductivity function into the Hall angle, one gets this data in which the inverse Hall angle, sigma xx divided by sigma xy, has in this Drude form, which we're assuming for the purposes of drawing these straight lines here, such that the real part is related to the scattering rate, which in Anderson-Ong model would be this Hall spin-on scattering rate, and the imaginary part is related to the Hall frequency, which in the Anderson-Ong model turns out would be a spin-on mass. But as a phenomenological picture, we can plot our data fitting to this, and what we find is these two quantities. And what we find is that the Hall scattering rate is about 70 wave numbers, whereas the scattering rate obtained from measurements of zero field conductivity, frequency-dependent conductivity, instead gives us about 190 wave numbers. So there's a difference of factor of two or three in the scattering rates. So these two different scattering rates are significantly different from each other. And the second thing that we obtain is that the mass associated with the Hall frequency, which can be defined as some sort of EB over MH, which MH, I'll remind you, is some sort of an average of the mass over the Fermi surface in Fermi liquid theory, is rather large and much larger than is found in the transport in sigma XX in the infrared. The mass found in the infrared from sigma XX zero field measurements is more like about 3. So we're talking about a factor of 2 larger mass for the Hall response.
What is your M0 there, the bare electron mass?
That's the bare electron mass, yes.
And in the latter, in the zero field measurements, the N over M, you're assuming N is, to get the M, you're assuming N is X?
There's various things you have to do to get that mass. I mean, you...
That the three or so comes from N.
Yes. You look at the sum rule integrated up to high frequencies, and so there's some manipulations involved in that. This is something that I would say many different experimentalists are finding roughly the same sort of numbers. They're sort of, they're making roughly the
measuring
same sort of assumptions.
Measuring N over M or measuring M?
Well, what they can measure is N over M, and then they can make assumptions about what N is. And when they make assumptions about what N is, they come up with a mass.
So the broad atomic age tau age remains roughly constant, or the crude accuracy constant, whereas tau age gets smaller and tau age gets bigger as the frequency increases. Is it a fair statement?
No, these two quantities are independent of frequency.
You said that the transport measurements, that was from the...
In the range of frequencies that these measurements are concerned with, up to 200 wave numbers, the mass and the scattering rate obtained from SigmaXX or zero field measurements is essentially not noticeable. There's no noticeable frequency dependence.
What is tau transport then?
Tau transport is the quantity that is obtained in the long wavelength limit. Actually, we measure this directly by just looking at the zero field transmission of our films and fit them to the simplest model.
But it's from Sigma XX.
It's from Sigma XX.
It's not Sigma XY. Uh-huh.
Yes, that's right. Yes.
But it just, does Victor or somebody able to tell you what the band theory number for that M sub zero is? I mean, that M sub zero is presumably the free electron mass.
Yes, that's right. That's correct. Yes. That's right. From ARPIS on YBCO and band theory combination, one gets out a mass and a mass at different points on the Fermi.
Yeah.
Well, two points, pi zero and pi pi, and the numbers are not terribly different than free electron mass. And one side is a little bit smaller than free electron mass in the pi zero direction, and the other direction is a little bit bigger.
I think the halving of J corresponding to
Yeah, well, I was just curious if somebody had actually calculated the Hall mass from band structure. It's just a convenient straw man. Well, the thing which would define omega H within band structure.
I mean, in BISCO, it's pretty accurately measured from the ARPIS data. The masses are pretty accurately measured. In YBCO, the ARPIS data has not, on the high resolution case, has not been so well done. But a combination of the existing ARPIS data and band theory, one can obtain what are estimations of these masses. And yes, in one case it's somewhat larger than the free electron mass. That's in a pi zero direction, pi pi direction. In a pi zero direction, it's somewhat smaller. So then we did some temperature dependence on this, temperature dependence of the Hall angle. And I'm showing you some data which I have to apologize a little bit for. It turns out the reason I have to apologize for it is because we measure independently the real and imaginary part of the Hall angle. And the real part is fine. The imaginary part has a little bit of a problem, which we have subsequently worked out. But I didn't make up the plot because we were too busy getting our underdoped data prepared. And so this has actually been corrected, so it actually goes through zero as it should physically. But it turns out to be not very important for the discussion because this is the imaginary part is very small in this region, and the inverse Hall angle is primarily controlled by the real part of the Hall angle. So the...
Should I know the answer as to why you stop at 95K?
It's TC. TC, yeah.
But could you come on down?
Yes, we do that below TC, but then the phenomenology changes a lot. You know,
you're going to show us that?
I wasn't planning to show that here. I have some data on that that I'm happy to talk to you about. But, you know, you're starting in the vortex dynamics, and a lot of other different issues come up. So mostly focusing here on the non-superconducting state.
I mean, below TC, you'd have to get into the vortex state.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And there's some nice phenomenology that occurs down there. I'd be happy to tell you all about it. But it's perhaps not a good thing to do in this talk. So the real and imaginary part of the inverse Hall angle, then, the real part, which is the scattering rate, according to the simple phenomenological model, rises with temperature. And the imaginary part, well, it's approximately linear in frequency. This is this data I mentioned to you that has subsequently been fixed, and so now it actually goes down through zero.
So the fixed data looked, as you would expect, simply linear in frequency and
yes.
extrapolating through zero.
Right.
So these oscillations, are they systematic or?
These oscillations are noise. This is low frequency measurement. There's very little intensity at low frequencies from broadband sources. This is broadband measurements. You know, measurements is a function of frequency. So these are in the far infrared range. We're talking about signals here which are approximately 1% of the total transmitted intensity. So they're difficult measurements. And there's a lot of noise in them. if we take these data for the real part and plot the scattering Hall angles scattering rate, the red boxes are approximately T squared behavior. This is the data I just showed you based on this increase in the real part as a function of temperature from this inverse of the Hall angle. And so it rises approximately T squared. The error bars get pretty large at high temperatures. It's pretty hard to distinguish the parameter accurately at high temperatures. Curves become very flat. And I've also included here another tau that we obtained by looking at the DC, the zero field response of these same films. So we're looking at the transmission in zero field as a function of frequency. And you see there is, at lowest temperatures, there is a frequency dependence. And it's this frequency dependence that we use to obtain some estimation of the scattering rate of the carriers. If I fit this to a simple Drude model, I'll get this number that I mentioned earlier of about 190 wave numbers. You can tell that because at 200 wave numbers, it roughly doubles its value. And so that's what it would be. Omega is equal to 1 over tau. But if we instead fit it to a model proposed by Offey and Mellis, in which the connectivity is proposed to go in the form of gamma minus I omega square root, inverse square root, it turns out to give a very nice phenomenological fit to these data. And if we plot those taus, those are the ones of the triangles. I'm not making much of a point about those because I don't think the experiment warrants, I don't think we have enough sensitivity, enough accuracy in this experiment to be able to say that this is necessarily a better description of the data than say a Drude model. But it does seem to be qualitatively consistent with the Hall angle, the scattering rate obtained from the Hall angle.
What's remarkable about it is that 250 degrees, you've already got a scattering rate which is faster than temperature.
You mean for the Hall angle?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, of the order of the temperature.
That's right.
Yeah. Yes.
Can you get some green dots at the high temperature?
Sorry?
Can you get some green dots at the
temperature? Here's what the problem is. If I look at this curve, it's saying, you know, what is the curvature of this data? right? And well, there's a good bit of latitude on, you know, what I would say the curvature of the state is. It's very hard to measure it. I mean, it's clearly something bigger than 200 wave numbers for the characteristic scattering. So it's very hard to determine from this. What one needs to do in this range is to measure the real and imaginary part of the transmission, which you could do in like a terahertz experiment. And so there are some experiments like that being done. Ornstein is doing those experiments. I think he's reported them here. And get a better idea from that. And by the way, I guess the answer, according to Ornstein, is it does not seem to follow this form that Yoffe and Melis has proposed. It seems to follow, according to what I understand, much more of a sort of a marginal Fermi liquid type of form. Okay, so I plot here first in the Hall response. I'm now going to the near infrared, 1,000 wave numbers. So this all we've talked about so far is low frequency, below 200 wave numbers. Now we go to a much higher frequency of 1,000 wave numbers. That is the range in which ARPIS finds there's no temperature dependence to the quasi-particle width. And the infrared conductivity finds that there's no temperature dependence to sigma 1 or sigma 2, no temperature dependence to the conductivity in the zero field response. And so this is the off-diagonal conductivity in the case of high frequencies, 1,000 wave numbers, and the field is 8 tesla, and we're plotting here the off-diagonal conductivity, real and imaginary part, as a function of temperature. And what is the most remarkable thing about this data is that it is strongly temperature dependent. We go down a factor of 5 in the value of the sigma xy as a function of temperature between 0 and room temperature. Whereas in sigma xx, the diagonal conductivity has no temperature dependence to zeroth order, no temperature dependence. Most of the temperature dependence is in the real part. The imaginary part is relatively constant. Remind you that the real part of sigma xy is actually the screening part. It's the imaginary part, which is the dissipated part of the off-diagonal conductivity. And I have also indicated up here a point, which is the predicted sigma xy based on the low frequency measurements that were made in a magnetic field where vortex dynamics was playing a role in which there was a strong resonance observed associated with vortices. If I take that resonance and just extrapolate its tail up to our frequency of 1,000 wave numbers, it predicts this point here. That can be expressed in terms of, well, n over m, in this case is the in terms of London penetration depth squared, and this Hall frequency observed in the superconducting state and omega squared. It just extrapolates like by omega squared. So it seems to be remarkably good agreement with that, suggesting that there's nothing going on between 200 wave numbers and 1,000 wave numbers in the experiment. And there is a frequency dependence you can see here. This is 1,000 wave numbers, 1,079 and 449. One thing that's important is you see the signal's bigger at the lower frequencies, which is telling you that whatever is responsible for this is some low frequency resonances. Okay, this is not coming from the interband transitions, this is coming from the low frequency resonances in the system, particularly the one at zero frequency, the Drude.
You can't go down below HC1, you're at 8 tesla, you can't go over the field much before your signal's gone.
In a film, HC1 is sort of micro tesla or something, so it's very hard to do an experiment on that.
Always vortex physics.
Micro gauss, maybe. Right. These are some new data on optimally doped. We have improved our apparatus. And I have so far here for the optimally doped just the Faraday angle. We haven't yet got the data needed to transform that into the Hall angle. But what I wanted to show you here was it's a relatively smooth, small variation until TC, and then it drops like a rock. And so there's a huge cusp or strong dependence in the Hall response occurring at TC in optimally doped. And there was a hint of that in the old data. It's just that now it's much more dramatically seen in our new data. So there is a very strong.
But I'm sorry. How is that? I realize this is in advance of. Yeah, I'm asking you to speculate in advance of the other half of your measurement. But roughly, how should this translate into the terms of the previous picture? Is it going to make the low temperature peak bigger?
Yeah, what it's going to do is in this.
Yeah.
Yeah. What it means is that what we saw here, a hint of the fact that this was coming over like a cusp.
Right.
I didn't want to claim that on this data, but with this data, I want to claim it. That this temperature dependence is actually very strong. It comes over at TC, and then it becomes flat.
Right. So the implication is it makes a sharper corner at TC, but it's not going to change the values at very low temperature very much?
Well, that's what I believe. After we do the analysis, we'll know that. Right. I mean, what is clear from this is that there is a very strong temperature dependence up to TC, and sort of a cusp-like behavior. So the vortex dynamics is playing a very role. So clearly, it seems that all of this stuff at low temperatures in the superconducting state can be understood in terms of vortices because of the fact that there's an agreement here with the low frequency data and the fact that there's this cusp-like behavior that would correspond to the vortices dying out. And when we get into the normal state, we have a different behavior. So the question is it really different or is it vortex dynamics in a normal state? That type of thing.
But just so that I understand, you're saying, I mean, that green point is the total conductivity. So whatever's going on with the vortices has subsumed whatever's going on in the normal state, right?
No, this is sigma xy.
Right.
And this is the conductivity sigma xy obtained from
the knowing about vortices.
Only knowing about vortices. That's
so
right.
Therefore, whatever exists at higher frequencies than vortices is simply not contributing.
No, this is the tail of that. See, this is the screening tail.
Right.
So I have a resonance at low frequency.
Right. But so if I understood you correctly, then you made a model which includes only vortices. And of course, that model has a tail in sigma xy, which goes up to high frequencies, and that gives you the green.
Yes, right.
Which explains essentially everything you measure.
Yes.
At that temperature.
Yes.
So then, when I go above TC, if I were to wipe out the vortices completely, I might imagine the conductivity would go, the sigma xy would go essentially to zero.
Right.
Because there would be nothing else. But it doesn't. Instead, it goes
right.
To
it goes
to
this point right here. Itself. Yes, that's correct.
So it's somehow you convert whatever you have in the normal state entirely into whatever this signal is that is coming from vortices.
That's right. So, there's several.
Or you just keep vortices.
Or you just keep vortices, exactly. It's still vortices in the normal state.
It's all was good game to say.
Yeah, but this is optimal.
This is optimal dope.
This is optimal dope. But
you can do it then.
Sorry.
But nevertheless, I mean, nevertheless, you can think of this as something adding on to what's going on in a normal state, or you can think of it as perhaps being related to vortices.
You have the data for the underdoped samples as well, but compare this with.
Yes.
Do you see anything?
Yes, I'm going to show you that.
Below the T star.
Yes, I'm going to show you that. First, I want to show you when we see. I looked at sigma xy first because YBCO has chains. Part of the conductivity, the sigma xx has contributions coming from chains. And so when I try to calculate the Hall angle, unless I know the chain contribution, I can't do it accurately. I have no way of knowing the chain contribution because these are polycrystalline. These are twin crystal, twin films. So I get some average over the chains, which I can't know. And that makes it so that when I look at the, say, the Hall angle, there is errors coming into this because of chain contributions to the denominator in sigma xx. So it's sigma xy, Hall angle is sigma xy divided by sigma xx. The sigma xx is sigma xx chains plus sigma xx planes. And the chains are something that I don't want to see. But that's all we can do. And there is errors coming into this because of that. We hope they're not too big. But this is what we get when we just simply calculate the Hall angle
from the observed sigma,
from the observed sigma xx. We do not try to correct for chains. And we look then at the inverse of the Hall angle, which is this phenomenological form, which seems to, we're testing if this phenomenological form works at these high frequencies. And what is seen is that, yes, in the case of the imaginary part, we still get something that is approximately constant with temperature, as we would expect from this form, and has a frequency dependence, as we also would expect from this form. And the real part looks like a temperature dependence, and this is the DC value of the Hall angle, the inverse Hall angle, and so it seems to be very consistent with the DC inverse Hall angle, the far infrared inverse Hall angle, and these high frequencies of 1,000 wave numbers.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but your data look more linear than...
I won't fight with you about that. I mean, I'll just want to argue that they're strongly temperature dependent. So if we then use that to convert these into scattering rates and Hall frequency for on the basis of that phenomenological model, these are the far infrared data. They're a little bit higher than these near infrared data, and that we attribute to this chain contribution. The presence of the chains will have lead to the reduction in the apparent Hall frequency because of the reduction in the apparent Hall angle.
You're saying that there's a sigma, there's a chain contribution in the mid-infrared which is bigger, relatively speaking, than the chain contribution in the far infrared. So the chains introduce more.
Right, exactly, yeah. Exactly, yes. And the thing is that the chain contribution is relatively flat.
Oh, I'm sorry, chains is relatively flat and the other one is coming down.
The other one's coming down. So in the far infrared, the chains are not nearly so important as they are in the near infrared. Yeah. And this is the Hall scattering rate. And for the far infrared, the green squares, the near infrared, the red and blue, and also there's a point here from our old data at 95 wave numbers, or 95 Kelvin. So all of these are pretty much consistent. And as Marcel was pointing out, that maybe it doesn't look like T-squared, but if we insist on T-squared and fit it, we get this curve here, a little bit of an offset. Again, I don't want to make a fuss about that. I mean, mainly here we're talking about a strong temperature dependence. I hope that by doing more careful measurements that we can do now, we can decide whether this is a T-squared or linear T or what form it is. If it is linear T, it has the problem that it wants to go through zero, in which case, you know, it would, at zero temperature, be a negative scattering rate or something.
I'm sorry, why does the chain contribution not propagate at gamma H? Why are the green boxes closer in gamma H than omega H?
I think it probably is because the value for the omega H that we use is sort of self-consistent. You know, we were using its lower value. And I think it's not as strong. I mean, I can't give you a really good analytic answer, but I think, you know, when I've fiddled with it, I have found that it's not as sensitive. I think the answer is because you're using this value of omega H, which is sort of self-consistently correcting for that. Do you have a question?
Yeah. So this Fermi liquid line.
Yes.
Where's it obtained?
Okay, so that, I'm glad you asked that question. The interesting thing is that there is a strong temperature dependence of the scattering, which, for the sake of argument, let us say that it is T squared. Then we can then say, well, it's T squared temperature dependence. On very general principles, we might expect that if it's coming from inelastic scattering, that it would lead to some frequency dependence, okay? And if we follow that argument through, we would say, well, it ought to have some sort of an omega squared plus T squared form. And I've written it in this particular funny way because I want to compare this temperature scale with omega. The W here turns out to be about 100 Kelvin. So the temperature, the energy scale for the T squared is quite low. And then once I determine W, I can predict what the frequency dependence would be, depending on what I assume for the coefficient of the omega squared term. Now, experimentally, it has been observed in heavy fermion systems that it's pi. There are some theoretical calculations, which Andy doesn't believe, which says it should be 2 pi. But in any case, these are sort of two numbers that we might compare with. And so if I take the the p equals 1, which is the case for heavy fermions, it turns out it would predict a huge offset. I mean, way, way off our scales. If I take the more conservative p equals 2, I get the curve that you saw in the previous graph, and I put that back up here this way to compare these scattering rates that we have with various other scattering rates. So this is the Fermi liquid prediction, okay? And so you can see there's no there's no frequency dependence. That's the bottom line of this. There's no frequency dependence with the scattering. Now we can compare with other measurements of the scattering rate in other experiments. So the sigma xx measurements measured by everybody gives a value of the scattering rate that's around 700 wave numbers. So we find that the Hall scattering rate is very small compared with that, particularly at low temperatures. And the ARPA's values are, again, much higher than these. These are 1,500 to 1,200 for depending on which ARPA's group you want to take. And they're temperature independent is the most interesting thing. And so the scattering rate, as interpreted as a scattering rate, is very, very different than all other scattering rates which one sees in cuprates. And the phenomenology seems to point to a scattering rate. So that's sort of the bottom line in the overdoped materials. We find what appears to be a nice, simple phenomenology with a Drude-like Hall angle, which has a characteristic scattering rate which is very different than other scattering rates observed in the cuprates. So I'm going to talk about the underdoped samples unless anybody has any questions about what I just showed you. This is new data, unless anybody has any questions about what I showed you so far. Okay, so this is data that we took essentially last week, and so it's not completely digested, so I won't be able to answer all the questions and details on this, but I want to show you this data, for it has a number of nice features. This is the 6.6 material with 55 Kelvin transition temperature, and I'm showing first the sigma XY, and you see that the strong temperature dependence, still very, very strong temperature dependence in the underdope, as in the overdope. Transition temperature is right here, so there's not much, there's not a huge feature up here as there was in the case of the optimally doped material.
I'm sorry, in the optimally doped material, where did it cross zero?
That's the other thing. It crosses through zero, which is another thing, which may make you nervous until you remember that this is still not a dissipative part of the conductivity, but the screening part of the conductivity. I might point out that the form, the Iaffe-Mellis form of the conductivity, which for sigma xy would be the form 1 over gamma minus I omega raised to the 3/2 power, would give you a rather nice fit to this, including the part that goes through zero.
What's the T star for this sample?
T star is about 160 Kelvin or 150 Kelvin. And that's the other thing, is that there's nothing there. Okay? Nothing at 150 Kelvin. Now, this is the real imaginary part of the inverse Hall angle for this sample. And now what you see is, I mean, even Marcel would have to agree that this is not linear. Okay, and it seems rather to be going, you know, pretty much through zero for the real part, which is the scattering rate, and the imaginary part unfortunately has a little bit of a temperature dependence now, I mean, unfortunately for this model, but I have done some, I mean, as I say, this data is very new, so I haven't really analyzed everything, but the problem with chains may be responsible for leaking in some of this temperature, the strong temperature dependence is occurring in the real part, might be leaking in a little bit into the imaginary part when I just interpret it naively.
But I'm sorry, is this DC or AC?
AC. This is a, oh, sorry. This is also at 1,000 wave numbers. Yes. This is
as was the previous one.
Yes. All of the data I'm showing you is minted for red data. Well, all the data I'm showing you is infrared, and all this data is mid-infrared data. And this is in a frequency range where there's no temperature dependence to the scattering rates observed in ARPAS or in SigmaxX measured with infrared reflectivity.
DC on the underdope doesn't show anything so different from optimal dope?
DC in the underdope shows some T-star type of behavior. It has a T-squared-like power law down to about 150 Kelvin, and then it falls off. The tangent of the Hall angle falls off below there with a different functional form.
I thought the chains don't do much in the underdope,
I guess. I guess I don't know the answer to that. I mean,
it must depend a lot on how you prepare it. I mean, if they're just randomly occupied at 50%, then I think what Patrick's saying is probably right. And
yeah.
I would guess that's the case in Europe.
Yeah, I mean, I know that in the severely underdoped, there's a lot of variation, sample-to-sample variation, which contributed to problems with the chain disorder. And so because of that, I sort of expect the change are making, making their presence known in the slightly underdoped material such as this as well. But it's something I just have to read the literature about and find out a little bit more about.
If I may say briefly, there's a complicated zoology, and localization often tends to be a low frequency effect.
Right.
So you get bumps at embarrassing places in the mid-infrared from the chains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. The oscillator strength has to go somewhere. So even if it goes away at DC, it will be there somewhere.
But the curve you showed that had the step upwards at TC in the optimal dope, that was just sigma XY. I mean, we're not seeing here the strong change.
That's
at
right.
TC.
We're
not seeing the strong change at TC.
That's correct.
Or indeed the sign change in, was it a sign change in the real part of the Hall angle?
Yes,
that you saw?
That's correct. If I can go back to those. Like this. So yes, this actually dropped below TC and became negative, what you're referring to. Yeah, and we don't see that occurring in the underdoped. Of course, the underdoped region is kind of narrow, right? We just have two data points below that, but this point is not down. That's the comparison. And this is the Hall angle. I mean, sorry, the Hall frequency and the Hall scattering rate deduced from this, again, naively ignoring chain problems. And so we get this T squared with a W now, which is slightly smaller, 70 Kelvin instead of 80 Kelvin, instead of 100 Kelvin. And a mass, I mean, if I take as the mass to be, if I take the frequency to be somewhere in the vicinity of 2.5 to 3 wave numbers, the mass turns out to be about 2.5. Compared with optimal doped, it was 6.2, and compared with ARPAS, it's 1.7. And so there's a huge difference between overdoped and ARPAS. The underdope seems to be coming closer to what you predicted by ARPAS.
Wait, this photo emission, is it optimal doping or under doping?
This is for optimally doped YBCO. Yeah.
Boy, and the signal in the data is omega H is 1 over mass. So this statement is that your omega H is a factor of 2.5 or something bigger than in the optimally doped material.
Yes, that's right, which you could see in the previous data. Let's see. Maybe you can't see it. Oh, you can see it in this data, right. Right, the characteristic omega H was somewhere around 1.2 in the optimally doped. So it's higher. And if I look at the temperature dependence of gamma H, it looks well, approximately t squared. This is plotting it versus t squared. So gamma h versus t squared seems to be approximately t squared. Nothing happens at 150 Kelvin. There's no hint of a t star in this data.
I thought all models tested in DC, there's no hint of t star in pulsing Hall angle.
In his Hall angle data for underdope, he says there's no no hint of t zero. But there is something at T star.
What is T zero?
That's the one shown in resistivity. You know, the change in slope that occurs in resistivity.
What is T star?
And T star is the characteristic spin gap in NMR measurements.
So 150 is supposed to be T star?
Yes.
Wait, 150 is the resistivity one, and something well a bit above 200 is the NMR one. I forget which is called which.
I thought it was reversed.
No, the NMR one is definitely higher than the resistivity. Well, I'm sorry, the uniform susceptibility one is somewhat higher than the resistivity, right?
And the C-axis conductivity just agrees with resistivity as far as T star?
I have to look that up. I mean, the problem is David left me, I shouldn't say, but left me to a state of total confusion about T zero and T star and all the other.
But I thought usually people say that from one over T, one.
Right. From the copper one over T1, that gives you 150, which is also where the resistivity is.
Mm. I don't know what your T star is.
Well, that is what Ong called T star in the paper that I read, and the T0, the resistivity, was much higher than that. But
So to answer the question, because I thought I asked the same question he asked before, T star, Ong does see something at a high.
Ong does see a characteristic break in the behavior of the Hall angle. As a function of temperature. At high temperatures, it has the T-squared behavior. As you go down in temperature, at a temperature around 160, it falls below that. The Hall angle falls below that characteristic form. So it's suppressed. The Hall angle is suppressed. And, yes. Okay, so that's it. No, there's no T-star. But a wonderful T-squared, which is very nice. So now I want to review for you briefly the comparison between transport and ARPAS as observed in these and other experiments with the ARPAS experiments. And so, as I say, the conductivity, the DC conductivity, can be expressed in terms of averages over the mean free path over the Fermi surface. And if you take just the diagonal mean free path observed in ARPAS and calculate the conductivity, you end up with 7,000. In other words, you assume isotropic behavior, you calculate 7,000 inverse ohm number of centimeters. If you go away from the diagonal, it's certainly going to get lower. The average will be lower. So this is an upper limit of conductivity as you can get from ARPAS, taking their quasi-particle lifetimes. Whereas measured transport in VSCO is more like 20,000. So it's very hard to understand the DC conductivity between ARPAS and transport. If you take directly measured their Fermi velocity and their widths of the momentum distribution curves, you predict a scattering rate of about 90 millivolts. This is again taking the diagonal, it's along the pi-pi direction, whereas transport, in any reasonable way of analyzing the data, gives you numbers which are much, much smaller. If I just take the simplest Drude form, I get a form like 18 wave numbers. If I took the Ioffe-Millis form, I would get something that would be half that big. You can also predict the plasma frequency, which turns out to be an average of K, F, and VF over the Fermi surface. And the ARPAS prediction is, well, plasma frequency of 2.1 one plus the mass enhancement factor, which you don't know. I mean, you can estimate. It's maybe 3. So we're talking here about maybe another factor of 2, so about 4 for the plasma frequency. In the transport measurements, it's only 2.5 for the plasma frequency, EVs. But it's clear that it's not saturated. You go up to, you know, the onset interband transitions, and it's still rising. And so the plasma frequency, the sum rule, the oscillator strain sum rule, has not saturated at interband transitions. And so there seems to be a higher energy scale than the cutoff corresponding to the interband transitions. Now, if I go to YBCO, where there's not as much known about ARPAs, there is some estimations, and the plasma frequency in that case is estimated from ARPAs to be about 3.2 EVs. And again, in the measurement, it's not saturated when it gets up to about 2.6. This difference in ratio of the square of the plasma frequency is only about a factor of 1.5. Now, if I look at this Hall frequency that we measure in our experiment, asymptotically, we can calculate what that should be in ARPAs too. And that should be a ratio of two averages over the Fermi surface, one of which is the velocity in KF, and the other of which is, well, it turns out to be the area of the velocity curve. If I take the the velocity as a function of position around the Fermi surface and construct a velocity curve, the area of that velocity curve turns out to be the quantity. It's actually the integral around the Fermi surface of VK crossed into dV dK, which is the area of the velocity curve. And we can estimate that reasonably well from ARPAs. And the result that we get for that is about 1.7 compared with, in the optimally doped case, a Hall frequency of about 6. I mean, mass. I'm talking about mass here. The Hall mass compared with the zero electron mass. So we're talking about a factor of 4 between the predicted value and the observed value for this Hall mass. There's a lot of spectral weight that is missing in the Hall angle. Even though the Hall angle doesn't change its frequency dependence up to 1,000 wave numbers, it acts like everything is independent of frequency up to 1,000 wave numbers, all the parameters. Nevertheless, there must be a lot more spectral weight up there somewhere. Suggests a higher energy scale that has to come in and contribute to the Hall angle above 1,000 wave numbers. So let me make a few remarks about models. The Anderson-Ong model works wonderfully. It predicts this form. Anderson predicted proposed T-squared for the Hall scattering rate. It's hard to understand why this characteristic energy is so small. It's 100 Kelvin. And it's hard to understand why gamma H would be independent of frequency. Why would you have a frequency-independent scattering rate? But the fundamental form was quite consistent with the experimental data up to 1,000 wave numbers. Now, I'll just mention that the technique is quite powerful in that it can falsify several other kinds of experiments. Sorry, Patrick, I have to bring this out. But the one I mentioned that Patrick Lee suggested some time ago, there should be some temperature-dependent factor times a Hall angle functional form, which decreases with temperature like 1 over T, which would explain the Hall effect that's observed in the Coupe rates. This has two problems. One is it in itself would violate there's a sum rule on the Hall angle, so it would violate this sum rule, because this sum would be this quantity, but it would be temperature dependent. Would be the numerator of this equation. Also, this form would predict a frequency independent Hall coefficient, which we observe a frequency dependent Hall coefficient.
Why? That presumably involves some extra statement about sigma xx.
Sigma xx, yes. And
so could I fix up their thing? Could I fix up their thing?
It'd be hard. I mean, if I just take the simplest sigma xx that works in far infrared, this is a far infrared statement. And in a far infrared, you don't have much latitude in changing sigma xx a lot, you know. So if I take any simple form, I'll end up with something that's pretty close to constant. And similarly, in the same way, the experiment can falsify the model proposed by Cotlier and Varma with essentially the same reasons. So the spectroscopic nature of the measurement allows one to get enough information you can actually show these models simply don't work. I won't go over the other models. I'd be happy to discuss any or all of them with anybody in private. And I'll just put up conclusions. And conclusions are that the most striking thing from the outset of this experiment is that in the mid-infrared, the SigmaxY has a very strong temperature dependence, in contrast to SigmaxX and ARPAS quasi-particle lifetimes at these frequencies. The second is that the infrared Hall effect supports the two-tile model with a phenomenology with a Hall angle that has a simple Drude form. It seems to describe the data quite well over the existing data, seems to quite well be described by this simple phenomenological form. With a scattering rate for the SigmaxX, the longitudinal currents, that has this max omega tau form, or omega temperature form, and the Hall scattering being T squared over omega, or W, with a 100 Kelvin characteristic energy, implies a very low energy scale in the problem. The fact that the two parameters of the model, omega H and gamma H, are essentially independent of frequency by experimental observation, suggests that the scattering that we're talking about here is not inelastic scattering. It's some sort of quasi-elastic scattering. The fact that omega H, as observed in experiment, is much smaller, this should be much greater than the fact that the mass is much larger than the mass that you would predict from ARPAS experiments is suggesting that there's a high energy scale in the problem, that somehow inelastic scattering has to set in above 1,000 wave numbers to eventually give you the right value for the Hall mass at very high frequencies, as required by the form of the Fermi surface and by the sum rules. And finally, the preliminary data on the underdoped YBCO, no T star or T zero. The scattering rate is somewhat stronger than in the optimally doped, and the Hall mass is somewhat smaller, closer to the value that would be given by ARPAS. Okay, so that's all.